Hey everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Chris.
I'm Rob.
I'm Jerry.
All right, so this week we're going to be talking about two different things here. For the first part, we're going to be talking about determining your own play style. We've kind of touched on this a little bit in previous casts, especially last week when once you know your play style, you kind of know what cards to look for. You know how to save money by going straight to what would be your play style. So this week we'll let you figure out how to do that. And then after the break, we're going to come back and talk about tightening up your play, just playing more mechanically, more tighter, not getting like violations and game losses off of mistakes, things like that. But all right, so let's start with play styles. Who wants to talk about like just the basic play styles?
All right. So currently there are six play styles that exist within the realm of Magic that are pretty consistent. You have your aggro decks, your ramp decks, tempo decks, mid-range decks, control decks, and your combo decks. Each of these decks in the order that I just gave them in are your fastest to slowest, with the exception of combo, being that it fits kind of in any position it needs to,
yeah,
depending on the speed of the deck.
Yeah, it bounces around a lot. And when we talk about speed in a deck, what we're talking about is generally like, do they want to win in the early game? Do they aim to win in the mid game or the late game? How far do they want land drops to go, the game to progress? What's better, what's worse for them? So I figure we'll start with aggro. I mean, that's really, I mean, how do you even talk? Chris, you want to cover this? You're the aggro player here. How do you feel about aggro? I mean, it's just, it's get you dead, right?
It's, yeah, I like aggro. It's very all in. There's not too many aggro decks really that have, if you're going past turn five or six, you're really looking alive. That's their biggest goal. They're looking turn four, turn five, trying to kill you.
Yeah.
The big thing with them is you have to be, like, people say control might be one of the hardest decks to play, and I've always made the argument that aggro decks are, because every point of damage matters.
Yeah. Definitely.
So when you're looking your lines of play, if I play this now, does this squeeze out every last point of damage I can? Because that next turn, you might not.
That window might close.
Yeah, yeah, that window might close. They might have something to counter, and you're just kind of stuck in the ground. So it's very, to me, it's very math intensive. It's very line intensive. If I play this, can he do anything to stop this? Yeah. How does this? It requires a very paying attention to the board state. People think it's just put cards on the table, turn them sideways. And it can be. It just depends on the format. But one of the things I look for is just, how do I squeeze every last point of damage out? Because if you give them too much room to play, well, now they get to take that extra turn or two. They start gaining life. They do something that wipes the board, and it's just not good for an aggro sense. I mean, would you agree, Rob?
I'd completely agree with that. I played aggro when I first started getting competitive, and like Bobby said, turn four, you want the game to be over. Generally, when I had games go to turn six, turn seven, I was on the ropes. My hand was almost completely empty. And you're just hoping for that top deck.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're looking at a quick game, get in. But like Chris said, like, especially now with prowess and with all of the instant speed, like Atarkus Command, things like that, where you can pump your team, and like looking at, how do I get the most out of these triggers? How do I get the most prowess triggers? How do I get the most damage through? And then even then, it's like this sort of poke and wait kind of game where you want to draw out your opponent's removal, but not spend your best creatures on it. Kind of, yeah, bait them with, you know, decent good creatures, and then follow it up with bigger things and bigger threats. And so, yeah, so I mean, you're looking at a low mana curve, and it this all aggro is a term that, depending on the format, depending on what's in standard at the time, it can be very different. Because we saw like the boss Sly style decks from Tom Ross, or the Sly in general, where it's like one and two drops and that's it, you're all in. There might not even be the best aggro cards. They're just the cheapest.
Yep.
And then you see more like a Tarka Red right now, where it's a little bit slower, but you still have explosive turns where you're kind of setting up, you know, an Atarkus Command to become immense, and you've got it spread out on one or two creatures, so that way if they kill one, you can pump the other in response. So, yeah, aggro is definitely a, you want to get them, you know, kill them as quick as you can, because every turn that goes on, you're less likely to win the game.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing when it comes to aggro is, if they're not dead on turn four, you want it established to where no matter what they do, they're dead on, yeah, turn five,
yeah,
is your biggest goal with aggro.
Yeah, in some formats, you'll run things like Exquisite Firecraft, the Uncounterable Burn, things like that, that you give you a little more reach in the later turns. But yeah, and I mean, then aggro also does kind of fall into the burn plan too, where you'll have less creatures, more burn spells, and that changes your lines of play a lot too. But overall, if you're a person who you're going in with your game plan, this is a very all-in, play-to-win deck where you only care about what your opponent's doing to the extent that it slows you down. Other than that, you're all in trying to, you know, get the life points to zero. So if that's your style, that's definitely, I mean, that's the way to go. I think aggro is, well, combo, which we'll get to too, suits that a little bit as well. But aggro is definitely an all-in game plan. You guys want to go down the list now?
Yeah, let's move on to ramp. I would like to talk about this one. I play ramp, and what separates ramp from like some mid-range decks, because a lot of people might look at a ramp deck and say, oh, that's mid-range. No, because I'm putting out a 5 or 6-drop creature on turn 4. And all the ramp decks do is they rely on your low-cost mana dorks. I was sad whenever Battle for Zendikar got fully spoiled and we did not have a 1-drop mana dork like Elvish Mystic. But we still have good ones, though. Beastcaller Savant, he has haste. He's a 2-drop, 1 and a green, but he's conditional with that one. He can only be used to cast green creatures. The other 2-drop that I really like to use is Rattleclaw Mystic. And then there's the renowned one that came out in Origins. I can't remember the name of him off the top of my head. He's a 1-drop, but unless or without a 1/1 counter on him, which he gets from attacking, he can't produce mana.
That card's name would be Honored Hierarch.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, because he's the kind of Noble Hierarch reference. Yeah.
Right. So, like, again, there's not great ones out there, but there are good ones out there. And then in the 3-spot, you have Shaman Forgotten Ways, which allows you to generate 2. But again, you have to use it to be spent on creatures. So there's conditional ramp out there right now, but it's still great. It still does really well. And the deck that I'm using it in is the deck that Alex posted about in Tap House Issue 1, which is the Rug 49 deck. And all its goal is to get your big creatures out as early as possible. Dragonlord Atarka, a 7-drop, getting him out turn 5. That's your goal.
Yeah,
and
pretty good.
With the ramp deck, though, you're not completely all in on the aggro plan because you have a little bit more spells to help support you. So you're able to draw a little bit later, too, and play as a mid-range deck if you need to.
Yeah, and there's a lot of land ramp right now, too. I know, Jerry, you're having some success with that right now, you and Alex both.
Yes, with the I want to make a point about ramp, actually. Old school ramp decks, they relied heavily on the two-mana spell, the two-mana rampant growth, your Explore, Colony Heart Expeditions, etc. The problem is that Wizards has made cards to push away from that, but in that, we now have a high influx of 3- and 4-mana ramp spells in Nissa's Pilgrimage, Explosive Vegetation, Frontier Siege. Because of the mass of all these big 3- and 4-mana removal spells, we're able to speed into our 8-drop Ugin, our 10-drop Ulamog.
Yeah, so I mean, you're basically, in ramp in general, the general premise is just generating unfair amounts of mana early on. And so to achieve that, you're looking at usually some pretty unimpressive turns 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 in this format, where you're basically just, you're doing your own thing, you're establishing your ramp. But then the payout for that is that you basically jump way ahead on the tempo swing because now you're playing, you know, 8 drops, 10 drops on turn 6, turn 7, and a lot of decks just can't handle that.
Yeah, how early did you drop your earliest Ulamog this past weekend?
Earliest Ulamog? That's a good question. But I can tell you that the best turns tended to be the turn 3 Nissa's Pilgrimage into a turn 4 Explosive Vegetation into a turn 5 Conduit of Ruin. Which is a 6-mana 5/5 that says search your library for a colorless creature with converted mana cost 7 or greater. Put it on top of your library. Colorless creatures. The first colorless creature you play per turn costs 2 less. Now to note, this is the first colorless creature you play, so it doesn't make your Ulamog cost 8 the same turn you play it if you had one in your hand already.
But yeah, but you can set it up. So yeah, so you have a nice Ulamog on the next turn. So that would be what, turn 6?
Yep, turn 6 Ulamog.
Yeah, 10 drop
pretty
on
tough
turn
to deal
6.
With. Yeah. So, I mean, so ramp is, it's sort of like, I guess you could call it in some formats, big aggro. You're not really on an aggro plan. You're just more on a plan of jumping ahead on the mana curve. Like, you're skipping a few turns there, and then most decks, like, a lot of them just can't deal with that.
You'll be getting to your stage 3 of the game well before a tempo deck or a mid-range deck.
And a control deck, any other deck, really.
When I say stage 3, what I mean is a good way to understand Magic games is when is your stage 3? There are 3 stages to a Magic game. Stage one is your setup. Stage two is your actual gameplay. And stage three is your close. Typically with these low-ended decks, aggro and ramp, you want to get to your stage three around turn four and turn six. But as you continue later on, your stage three closes out because the stage three of the bigger-ended decks is much longer.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're beating them to the punch, basically. You're beating the long decks to the late game, which the late game is generally where they want to be. So if you can beat them there and establish your win condition first, then you're looking pretty good. What do you think draws a person to ramp?
I think what drew me to ramp really was I enjoyed playing aggro when I played mono red, but I saw that aggro quite a few times lost to those bigger creatures. I wanted to stay quick, but I also wanted to be able to put out those big creatures at the same time. So that's when I made my move from just playing mono red aggro. I then jumped into gruel monsters or red green monsters at the time, and it did great, and it solved every little problem that I had. I can't go late game. Well, now I can. Or, you know, I want to end this game quick. Well, it turns out a turn three, a Pelucranos, and then a turn five, 18 damage. That's going to win you a game.
Yeah, I think it's, do you like to play big stompy creatures ahead of turns?
Yeah.
And if you like big stompy, like ramp decks are probably going to be your thing. If you look like looking at something that says like 6-6, 7-7, you know, whatever the case may be, That's probably your style, or anything that's probably, we'll say, what, 5 or higher for a converted mana cost? That's your jam.
You'll be digging it.
I mean, for me, when looking at the ramp strategy that's now in the standard format, it was what beats Ugin and Ulamog? What beats them two when they're both on the battlefield? That was really what it came to.
Next to nothing, yeah. It puts your opponent in a real tight spot. And yeah, so now is a great time to be playing ramp. Ramp is one that, it sort of comes in and out for standard, and like how all in it is changes also. Because if you're playing a deck where you play like one, you know, elf tap for green kind of deal, that's kind of like a light ramp. You still have other stuff going on. The Eldrazi ones that we're seeing now are going to be like all in kind of ramp decks where it's Ulamog or bust, or it's Ugin or bust, it's big creature or bust. But they've got plenty of ways to get there and to set that up.
Now, the downfall of most ramp decks in history was always opening hands of, I got all this ramp, I'll get up to 12, 13 mana, but I'll never have anything to follow up with.
Yeah.
And ramp decks today have a lot of tutor power, the ability to put cards from your deck into places you want them to be, whether it be your hand or the top of your library.
Yeah, so being able to search up a threat definitely helps you, because when you're looking at the deck list, it's mostly ramp with fewer of the payout creatures. I mean, in the list you're running right now, Jerry, how many? It's like, what, 4 Ulamog? How many?
4 Ulamog, 3 Conduit of Ruin, 4 Ugin.
Yeah, so you're looking at, what, 11 cards there versus the rest of the deck? So
11 cards where 3 of them will tutor, From Beyond will tutor,
yeah,
and the Sanctum of Ugin land will tutor.
Yeah, so that's, you know, to Jerry's point, when you're looking at it, if you remove those tutors, your probability is, it's not low to hit those cards, but there are definitely games where it happens. So now with those tutors in place, like, it's looking pretty solid. I know also sometimes, depending on the build and everything, a hard point for ramp decks can be control. Because if you ramp into this and then run into a counter spell, sometimes that can slow you down. But that's all going to be determined by the card pool available to you. Sometimes you have, like, I know Guy's Revenge is coming out of the sideboard. Can't be countered, right?
Can't be countered, and it can't be targeted by non-green sources.
Yeah, so that's a great one to sideboard into for it. You've got plenty of ways to deal with that right now. And with all the tutor, you can just go look for another threat. So it's pretty well positioned right now, and I think that'll be around for a while. What do we got next after ramp? We going into tempo?
Tempo.
Yeah, who wants to take tempo?
So the tempo archetype is what I like to call the aggro control. You can play both matchups, but what you really want to do is, in an opening hand, have a threat. A quick, cheap threat, and try to protect it and get it through. The best tempo creature right now in standard is your Mantis Rider. 3-3
yeah.
for 3 yeah, with yeah. Flying, Vigilance, and Haste. As soon as you drop one, you get in your 3 damage, and you play the Protect It game. Try to protect it with couple counter magics and valorous stances and using burn spells to close out the game.
Yeah, and if you look at like Modern and Legacy, Delver is usually the quintessential tempo deck. And
Delver is your primary go-to tempo. It really is both Modern and Legacy.
So it's sort of like, you know, yeah, tempo or control aggro is a great way to put it, because where control wants to completely shut the game down and go to late game, tempo wants to sneak in a good, you know, efficient threat and then just protect him. Just sit back, stop you from killing them, stop you from killing their threat, and just beat you down.
I played Alex's Jeskai tempo deck at Friday Night Magic just this last Friday. And one thing I noticed with his is it's not necessarily, like, his didn't have a lot of control to it, but it was very much you had to look and evaluate. He had quality cards.
Yeah.
To where you had to decide, was I going to control the board by letting this one card stay there and eventually letting you kill it because you'd have to? And then following up with just another threat. So that's cool. You killed my Manus Rider. Here's a Thunderbreak Regent that you're going to take 3 damage to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, so it, I didn't consider it control, but really when I started evaluating, it really was. It was, if you're going to deal with my threat, you're going to hurt yourself in some way.
Yeah, it's got the aspect of, and yeah, I guess we need to clarify that, where it's not control in the sense of I'm going to kill every single one of your creatures. I'm going to counter everything you try to play. It's more so, you're picking off the main pieces that they have, or the main things getting in your way. So you're mostly letting them do their game plan, but you're just messing with them enough to slow them down so you can stay ahead on the clock.
Yep. What causes you the most problems?
Yep. Yeah. So any roadblocks that come up, you have things to deal with it. And then, like you said, like, you've got plenty of more threats. So if your initial threat gets taken out, you're good to go. Manus Rider is great because they can take out one and then it has haste. So you play the next one, you're good to go.
Yeah.
And the Vigilant, so it's on blocking duty. I mean,
an important feature to recommend, to note on tempo is also, as you said, spell selection, what you want to select. You also need to understand that card selection is probably the most important piece. For example, in your Legacy tempo decks, Brainstorm and Ponder are your go-to card selection pieces. Knowing your matchup, you know, you're walking in against, say, an opposing Delver deck. You know you need your Lightning Bolt. So when you cast that Brainstorm and you see the 2 Lightning Bolts and, say, a Force of Will, well, the Force of Will is not going to be as good as the 2 Bolts. So you need to understand your card selection, picking and choosing what you need to get the problems out of your way.
Yeah, it plays very much like control in that, where you pretty much need to identify your opponent's deck as soon as you can and then figure out the best ways to kind of pick apart their game plan and slow them down. So it's a great deck for someone who wants to play control but doesn't entirely enjoy that late game style. It's definitely a lot of that, lots of lines of play. If you like lots of lines of play and lots of, I guess we need to go into that some too, because we haven't really talked about that much. So whenever we reference lines of play, what we're talking about is options, choices, decision trees. So whenever you're looking at your hand and you're saying, okay, I can either play my threat this turn or I can take out their threat. So you need to make decisions like that, where what's better for you. Usually in tempo, you want to get your threat on the board so you can start beating them down. But it always changes. Every matchup is different. Some people hate that index. Some people love it. So if that's something where it's one of those ones where you don't have an all-in plan, so you're not going to just beat certain decks. You're not going to just have a heyday. I mean, you'll have good matchups, but it's not like aggro where you can just slip under, call it a day, you're done. You're always going to have to fight a little bit, but you're always going to have cards to fight a little bit. So you've got to be good at picking your battles, kind of knowing what your opponents are weak to. So if that side of the game you enjoy, then yeah, tempo would be a great choice. Now, tempo and standard is kind of a fickle beast, though, because it's not always really prevalent. So right now, yeah, Jeskai is looking great. I mean, Jace is a great tempo card. Manus Rider is a great tempo card. So if you want to try it out, now's a good time.
It's got one of the best card selection spells ever printed in Dig Through Time, and Treasure Cruise is pure advantage.
Yep, so you've got lots of rewards for playing tempo right now. But all right, let's continue on down the list. We got mid-range next.
Yeah, next we got mid-range. All right, so this is getting into your later game. You're not really relying on ramp so much. You do have more creatures. I think Abzan would be a good
example of mid-range. It gets listed as control sometimes, and that's because mid-range can kind of be...
Mid-range tends to bleed into control,
depending on the build. Yeah, it's either like a big, big aggro, or it's a light control kind of deal. So yeah, so Rob, you want to carry on?
Yeah, sure. So a big thing with that one is, if you look at, again, I'm going to be picking at Abzan for this one because I really think it is one of the best mid-range decks out there.
Yeah, it's great.
You've got Siege Rhino, you've got Wingmate Rock for your late game drops and that, and you have a whole lot of spells too, more so than you would in your ramp deck and your more so in your tempo decks, I would say, as well. Your tempo decks, you're looking to control your creature, whereas I think mid-range, you're looking at just beating down those bigger creatures, those bigger threats, because you know you're going into the late game and you need to be able to handle those. So you're looking at more kill spells. You're looking at like Utter End, board wipes two. And it's just a matter of, again, making it to that later game, that turn six, turn seven, when, like Jerry referenced, you enter your stage three. You start to enter your end game and being able to execute it. And it's a slower play. You can try to be aggressive with it, but you need to keep in line of what your opponents are doing as well, because very easily I've seen a mid-range deck try to get played by an aggro person. Yeah. And they don't identify that, hey, this deck is a little too slow for me. I'm moving too quick for it. And it results in them losing.
I think the good part, though, about a mid-range deck is with your sideboard, you can determine what you want to do. Yeah. So you can piece together your sideboard to game one be mid-range, game two be aggro, or game two you can go control. It just depends on what you want to put in your sideboard. Because, I mean, that's what we saw with Abzan a lot up to this point was they would either go to the Abzan aggro if they were playing a, especially in the mirror because it was prevalent everywhere, if they were playing a more control build. So they'd go the aggro route to try and close it out sooner because it had good cards to do that.
Yeah, you could swap Languishes for Fleece mainlines before rotation, things like that. Because, yeah, with a mid-range deck, you're almost dead center in the scheme of things to where if you're playing against a control deck, well, now you're the aggro deck. If you're playing against an aggro deck, well, now you're the control deck. And I think, like, a great example of mid-range right now is Languish with Siege Rhino. I mean, that has mid-range written all over it. So I'm going to play my Siege Rhino, get myself back in the game with a little bit of life. Next time I'm going to play a Languish, sweep your board. Now most aggro decks are looking pretty sad at that point.
As you start getting deeper with the bigger, longer game decks, your mid-range and your control decks, card pieces that they're looking for are your two-for-ones, your value cards. This is where the... You see, Siege Rhino is the penultimate in mid-range. It comes into play, and it immediately gets you a life swing. Even if they remove it, you still got the life swing. You still got the value out of it. Value is important to recognize, and some of the best mid-range decks in the history of Magic have been nothing but value cards. I mean, look at the Jund in the modern format. What brought it back into the format was Kolaghan's Command. Every time you activate the card, it's always a 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. It's never not a good card to have in your hand. Another good example would be Huntmaster of the Fells. Creature that enters the battlefield, gains you 2 life, gives you a wolf token. Now your opponent has to spend 2 resources to deal with just the 1 resource you spent. Yeah. So it's really a resource. It's another resource advantage deck as you get deeper and deeper.
Yeah, it's a game of attrition, yeah, where you want, I mean, sweepers are a great example, too. I play a Languish, I get 3 of your guys for my 1 card. Now I'm looking pretty good. I've got more answers in hand. You're out of things in your hand because you dropped it all on the board. So, yeah, so, I mean, you're looking to value out your opponent. I mean, that's a great way to put it. As far as players who would lean towards this, I think mid-range might be one of the best decks to learn on as you get more competitive because you've got game in most matchups. You're not locked into one playstyle too heavily, so you can kind of get a feel for everything. If you find yourself wishing it was faster, you can move towards that end of the spectrum, or if you wish you had more answers, then you can move towards that end. I mean,
it's definitely the skill tester on understanding if you are the beatdown or if you are the control.
Yeah, you'll get to learn that lesson every single round of every single tournament and always find yourself trying to figure that out.
Yeah, a lot of people tell the new players to play an aggro deck, and I don't necessarily think that's wrong, but when they'll get frustrated really easily if they're playing a little bit more in the format where people have started figuring out how to deal with it, whereas mid-range usually just has value card after value card, where when you're playing... As you're learning, you are just playing such good cards, you can still win as you're learning. Like, Siege Rhino is the perfect one.
I've seen a lot of bad players win games with Siege Rhino.
I mean, because people look at it as, you know, oh, well, you lose 6, or you lose 3, I gain 3. A 6-point life swing for a 4-power card that has a big butt, a 4-5 with trample, like, that's a super relevant card.
Yeah, 4 mana for you lose 3 and I gain 3. That card wouldn't see play, but it's not the worst card ever. It would see limited play. Like, it would be a decent card. So when it comes to the 4-5 attached to it, like, yeah, that's the epitome of value right there. That's a good card for mid-range. But, yeah, so, I mean, it's definitely a skill tester. It's definitely – it will get you good at identifying your matchups, what you're sitting across from. Chris made a good point there, too, where – aggro, like, if you're the type of person where if your game plan A doesn't work, you get salty, aggro and combo are probably not the decks for you.
Absolutely
like,
not.
That's a big thing for me. Like, aggro, man, I tilt. So I'm pretty good about not tilting, but aggro, I'll tilt all day right out of my chair. Like, just because, like, I love to have wiggle room. I love to have more lines of play. So mid-range, yeah, that's a good one to go if you're that type of person. You guys want to get into control now?
Yes, Bobby, take it away.
Yes, Bobby.
All right, please. So here we go. It's so fitting that we touch this one last.
All hail the Lord and Savior, Sphinx's Revelation.
Absolutely. I miss that card every day.
I don't.
But yeah, so control is the epitome of I want to go late game. I'm looking to following the same kind of range as mid-range where I want to outvalue you. I want to kill three of your dudes with my sweeper. I want to refill my hand. I want to have seven cards. I want you to have two. Like, it's all of my exchanges, you want your exchanges to be valuable because the hardest part of control is getting to the late game. Usually once you get to the late game, you're good. Your deck's built to just soar in that phase. So getting to the late game is pretty much your biggest concern. Now, as far as player style that would benefit from this, if you like puzzles and problem solving and trying to, a lot of times you find yourself like, all right, if I let this live, I'll take three damage. If I kill it now, I might prevent three for the next few turns. But if I kill this, he might play a bigger threat. I mean, a lot of times you're picking at your brain to figure out what's in your opponent's hand, what is their game plan, what are they trying to do, and how can you best alleviate it? Because only in formats like, I mean, blue-white control and Theros block before rotation was great because you could play control and get away with being a little bit looser of a player because cards like Sphinx's Rev would get you back into the game. Whereas right now, I mean, every point of damage you take counts, but you have to know when to allow damage to come through so you're not blowing good answers too early. So, I mean, it really is like, if you like drawing cards, if you like playing late into the game, that's the way to go. The biggest downside to control is you got to learn how to play fast. It's kind of a tricky style to play fast at first, but that's should be top priority if you like control, is learning how to play technically quicker so you're not going to time and getting a bunch of draws. You guys have thoughts on control?
Yeah, I do. Two important points to pick up on. The resource management you had already pointed out, Bobby. This is the deck that wants the most bang for its buck. You want to get three cards per your one card.
Yeah.
Almost every single time. And as for the late game goes, this deck's type of stage three gameplay is the game is over at that point.
Yeah.
Control stage three is nigh impossible to get out of. Magic is magic, variance applies, but you have a 95% win rate when you're on your stage three plan.
Yeah, because at this point, you want to be in a situation where you're holding two or three counter spells. You've got 12 or so lands in play. You've got a threat out that's slowly grinding them out, or depending on the format, is quickly grinding them out, and you're just waiting to finish the game. Usually at this point, your opponent is no hands, no cards in hand, nothing going on. So they top deck something, you counter it, you continue the beat down. It's just getting to that point is the tricky part. And it takes a lot of, like Jerry said, there's a lot of times where it's tempting to use a sweeper on two cards, but if you do it, now they have follow-ups, you may not have another answer. You really have to be patient and make them play out everything in their hand. All right, so then that'll bring us to our last play style here, which would be combo.
Woo!
All right, Jerry, take it away.
All right, so combo is, the best way to explain it, the rules breaker. It tries to get to stage three as quickly as possible and end the game on the spot at stage three. There are two types of combo decks that exist. You have your combo in shell decks, such as your control decks with a combo out like Splinter Twin or Scape Shift. And then you have your pure combo decks where your entire deck is based on amassing certain spells together to go off, quote unquote, to end the game on the spot.
Grizzle Shoalbrand.
Storm. Yep.
Storm.
Yeah, I got quite a few. So basically the difference here is, are you an all-in combo deck, which would be similar to aggro, is that fair to say?
It's a, like how you said, control's a puzzle piece. The all-in combo decks are also puzzle pieces, but they have that aggro feel where you are ending the game as quickly as possible.
You want your clock to be quick. You're looking for, which essentially as soon as you feel comfortable going off, you're going off. That's it. Whereas in shell, it's usually in a control shell. I don't know if I've seen any examples of...
Yes, there is an aggro shell. Alex plays it. It's Kiki Cord.
Oh, right. Yeah, good point. Yep. Good point. Yeah, so basically this is a deck whose main function is either aggro or control, but it finishes the game with a combo.
Elves does a similar thing.
Elves should definitely qualify. So what you're looking at for these would be things like Scapeshift and Modern also, where it's the combo is more a necessity than the point of the deck. It's sort of on the back page where, like, Scapeshift, it's a control deck that just wins with a combo because in Modern, you really can't go, you can't play forever. You're going to get punished. But, Jerry, continue on. Let's focus on pure combo decks.
So, pure combo, to understand a pure combo deck, you have to split your deck up into three pieces. Your Mana Excel, your combo pieces, and your building pieces. Typically, your draw spells, your cantrips. You also need to understand, when you go off, what spells are necessary in your hand to go off? For example, my favorite combo deck in Modern is Ad Nauseam. This is the simplest one to understand because it's a two-piece combo deck where you either have Angel's Grace, which is a one-mana instant with Split Second that says you don't lose the game this turn, your opponent can't win the game this turn, and any damage you take reduces you to one will reduce you to one instead. And Ad Nauseam, which I think we've mentioned before, five-mana instant, reveal the top card of your library, put it into your hand, lose life equal to its cost, you may repeat this process. These two cards together puts my entire deck in my hand, therefore I can do anything with any type of Mana Excel out of my hand.
Yep, so you're looking at, and what's the card, the win condition? What's the main one in that?
It's Lightning Storm, 3-mana red instant. It's a 2 red and 1, where target player takes 3 damage plus X damage, where X is the number of charge counters on Lightning Storm. Lightning Storm has an activated ability on it that says discard a land card to put 2 charge counters on it. Put your whole deck in your hand, exile 3 Simian Spirit Guides, which says add 1 red to your mana pool. You exile the 3 Spirit Guides, cast the Lightning Storm, discard 9 lands for 21 damage to the face.
Yep. So essentially you're looking at once you draw your whole deck, the combo's in hand, you're good to go.
Yes.
So as you said, you've got setup where what? You're playing out your artifacts, sort of your mana rocks, your different accelerations to get to Ad Nauseam.
Yes, it's a Mana Excel into Ad Nauseam. The other piece to the deck you can use to issue out Angel's Grace is Phyrexian Unlife, which has a unique rules thing where
yeah.
Damage causes loss of life, but loss of life doesn't cause damage. So you cheat the system by going into negative X life once again off of the fact that you don't lose for having 0 or less life.
Yeah.
With Phyrexian Unlife.
So as you said, these are sort of the rule breakers decks where you have a lot of cards that, like Gifts Ungiven was another one before they errated it, where you could search your deck for you could search your deck for 4 unique cards, put them into your hand. But the workaround for that is whenever you're looking in a hidden zone, you can fail to find. So people would only find 2 cards, and we won't get into that combo too much. But the point is usually you're breaking some card to some extent. You're using it not as intended, and doing so you get a kill out of it.
And the final piece to understand about combo decks is all combos fall to silver bullets, meaning when I say silver bullet is a particular card will end your game plan.
Yeah.
For example, back to Ad Nauseam. Spellskite. People can redirect the Lightning Storm to the Spellskite. You need an answer to that. So when you build a combo deck, you need to be able to build answers within the deck, either within its sideboard or the main board, to deal with particulars. These silver bullets, you know, for Storm, Thalia, Guardian, Athraven, making all non-creature spells cost 1 more. You can't combo off that. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. So what type of player would you suggest try out combo?
Anyone who loves hard puzzle pieces and wants to not necessarily play control and be there all day. Nothing against that, but that's a way to put it.
It's like people that do Rubik's Cubes for speed. That would be...
Combo decks are also really great if you learn how to play one, and it's really great for an open or a long tournament event because you will have time in between your rounds to, you know, go to the bathroom, get food, whatever have you.
Get situated. Yep, you have fast games, and you're all in on your game plan, too. That's a great point. For long events, any deck that's all in on its own game plan is usually a lot better suited because you can't account for all the possibilities you're going to face all day. What's up, Rob?
And that's one thing that I like that I was going to bring up about combos is you're just doing your own thing. And, on the opposite end of it, it's terrible seeing the person go through because you put your hand down, you sit back, and you're just...
Here we go.
Here we go. Yep, this guy's going to try to storm off. Does he fizzle? But also, too, like the Glass Cannon that combo decks are, or Silver Bullet is what Jerry used, these decks can lose so easily, and it's disheartening, and you need to be able to deal with that pain. So it almost takes, like, a person who loves hurting themselves almost to enjoy this deck, because you're going to go out, and the first combo deck I got into was Amulet Bloom, and man, first two rounds, I did great. Everything went off right. The next four rounds, I could not catch my key pieces to save my life.
Yep. So, I mean, those are the woes that you'll see. And, I mean, no matter what your play style, no matter what deck, there's always going to be something that has that effect on you. All-in decks tend to kind of do it to themselves at times, whereas reactive decks tend to get caught by, you know, some random card someone liked in draft and threw in their deck, and you don't have an answer for it. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's... Once you find your play style, it makes Magic, especially competitive Magic, a lot easier for you, because now you know what to look for. You know what things you like, what you don't like. So definitely, you know, let us know if you have any questions about this. But all right, we're going to get out of this segment. So we'll be back in just a minute to talk about tightening up your play. All right, welcome back, everybody. So for this segment, we want to talk about tight play. Tight play can cover a lot of different things, a lot of different scenarios, but really when you break down Magic, I always like when pros use the analogy or the comparison of it's all percentage points. There's a lot of variance in the game, things you can't deal with, but there are tons of things that you can deal with. And by just playing tightly and well mechanically, you can edge out a few games probably per month that you wouldn't get otherwise. That might be a bit of a big figure there, but at least one a month, I would imagine you can get. So any game win that you can get for essentially free is good. So you guys got any stories to start this off, where tight play hurt you or helped you or didn't help you?
It really wasn't tight play. It was more of calling a judge. Which would confirm tight play.
Yeah.
If you're unsure of an interaction or anything, call the judge. All events, all of your big sponsored events, they have judges there. Call them. They're there for you. My interaction was casting Mutagenic Growth and having myself get hit with damage from an Eidolon of the Great Revel. And the way that Eidolon Great Revels reads is whenever you cast a spell with a converted mana cost of 3 or less, you take 2 damage. I was running Infect. I was at 7 life. I knew I was going to take 6 points of damage. But my opponent argued the point that there are multiple steps when it goes into your spellcasting phase, which is true. There are. Whenever you break down each phase, there's actually a lot in there. And upon the announcing or the casting, the initial casting, that was, hey, this is lesson 2. It did the check. I lose 2 life. I lose 2 from the mutagenic growth. And that would have just put me at 1, which is where I calculated myself. But as the spell resolved, he said I took an additional 2.
Oh.
Yeah. And the players next to us, they were hearing the conversation we were having because I was questioning it, and both of them agreed. So now here I am, 3-1, unsure. You know what? I'm pretty sure this is right. Looks like I just lost myself the game. I later then went and talked to a judge, and they said, absolutely not. You should have called one of us. And I would have won the game because I had the kill on the board, and he knew had I cast Mutagenic Growth, in his eyes, I lost.
Yep. So, judge calls. We'll start with judge calls because this is something that can be intimidating to newer players. It can be you feel like you're putting the judge at, you know, you're bugging them, you're wasting their time, but this is what they're there for. They get paid, they get compensated one way or another for this. They know that they're going to be here doing this all day. One habit that I've gotten into is if I'm only 99.9% sure of an interaction, I still call a judge and check. There was a modern match where I was almost positive that a flip Delver had a CMC of 0, but, you know, I've never had to deal with this before, so let's get a confirmation. You can easily call a judge. You can have them step off to the side with you so you're not giving away information about the game or anything, and they'll confirm it. They confirmed I was right. I was good to go. I went and played on like normal, but... Once you commit to casting something, once you've revealed that information, you can't take that back. So you really need to do this preemptively to make sure you're in the clear and you're making the right lines of play. And you know, and if you feel like your opponent might be uncomfortable or something like that, feel free to tell them, hey, you know, I just have a quick question, and then call a judge. No one's ever going to be upset about that. So this is backing up to a slightly different situation with Rob, where if an opponent disagrees with you, call a judge. Like, you lose nothing for doing it. And if it doesn't sound right to you, call the judge.
Yeah, worst case is you get a time extension and you had a little more time to think about your line of play.
Yeah.
And a judge confirms exactly what's supposed to go on.
He'll give you a more accurate description of the events. Because a lot of times players have sort of even if they're right on what they think is going to happen, they may not always be right about why it happens. So it's good to know that for sure. And I mean, I don't know if this is what was going on at that store, but there also stores are very clicky. And if someone from their area is going to win, if it's the right, then they may be more inclined to say that, yeah, that's right. So yeah. Don't trust players around you. Don't waste time with that.
I'm a huge fan of the judge call. I mean, Bobby saw one where we were playing a burn matchup. The guy played a spell, and I began thinking, do I need to respond to the Eidolon trigger, or do I need to just let this resolve? And in the process of me thinking, I never passed priority. He declared attacks, and so he says, I missed the Eidolon trigger. And even Bobby at the end of the game said, I would have called a judge.
Yeah,
because it was just such fast play. So calling a judge is that's your resource, especially if you don't know what's going on, and use it to the end that you can.
Yeah, because in Magic, there is no such thing as I can't force you to a next phase or pass your priority by tapping a creature to attack or by doing anything. You always have to pass priority to get to that point. So if you haven't passed priority and your opponent thinks you have, call a judge. Like, if you didn't explicitly say something or take an action that implied it, you haven't passed priority yet. So
another good resource on judges, a lot of players don't know, is you can call judges for oracle texts on cards.
Yeah.
Specifically for, the part of the problem of this is I like to play with a lot of foreign cards. You don't know the wording on a card. Call a judge. Don't be afraid. You can ask a judge, hey, can I have the oracle text for this card? Say if I'm pointing out a foreign card. Or if you don't know the name of a card, if you describe a card to a specific what it does. Like, for example, I'll use Angel's Grace since we used it earlier on. Angel's Grace, say, I want the oracle text on the card that costs one mana and says, I don't lose the game, and you don't win the game. And the judge will show you an oracle text.
Yep, as long as you can narrow it down enough to where they're sure it's just that one card, they can pull it up for you.
And that's good, too, because oracle texts have changed as the game, like, Leyline of Sanctity. Now it just simply says you have hexproof.
Yes.
So maybe whenever they printed the cards originally to where they're at now, Wizards has changed exactly what they want that card to do.
Yep. So let's get away from judges some, and let's just talk about what you can do personally within the game of Magic to tighten up your play. Information is super important in Magic. I think that's the biggest hurdle newer players have to becoming more competitive, is just learning how much information you can gather from simple things like playing a land straight from the top of their deck when they draw it, to tapping mana and changing their mind and untapping it, things like that where you leak information if you're not playing tight. So one of the biggest things for this is when you're looking at your hand and you're determining your line of play, lock into a line of play before you do any like physical movements, before you start to tap lands, before you start to lay a card down, anything like that. Be sure of what you're doing before you actually do it. And I mean, when you first start doing this, it's going to slow your games down a little bit. Maybe this is something to practice at kitchen table at home before you take it to a tournament. But just get in that habit of that second check before you actually commit to anything. I know that I see it all the time where a player is maybe trying to pretend like they have something in hand, but it's actually a land. They start to play it and decide not to. Well, now I know it's a land. Like, just little bits of information like that can up your percentage points. So being aware of it and also not doing it yourself will be a huge help for you. Do you guys have any good examples for this that you've come across?
Forming good, consistent habits, for example. Oh yeah. When playing against some players, you'll notice, like you said, when they... Some players will draw a card and they'll flip it through their hand and then they'll play a land and then they'll draw their next card and they won't do anything. They won't play a land. They'll draw the next card, play a land. They'll draw their next card, flip it through their hand, play a land. That's a telltale sign that, okay, every time you flip your cards to your hand, you're playing a land.
Yeah.
So you need to form constant habits. Every time you draw a card, flip through your hand. Every time, flip through your hand. Little things like that.
Consistent habits.
Yep.
Every time you shuffle your deck, you will shuffle it in a specific way. Don't be fast with it. Don't get slower with it. Make it consistent so you're not giving away telltale signs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a great example, too, where if you're running out of time on the clock and you know you don't have fast answers, you may be shuffling super fast to try to hurry up and get the game started. Well, now they know, okay, this guy doesn't have fast answers for me. You know, I can probably beat him out with time. Anything that you do that you've deemed right to do within Magic, do it every single game. Even things simple as where you place your library, where you place your graveyard, where you put exiled cards, just so that way there's never any confusion. I mean, you want to make sure that it's clear. I've seen a few times on camera where, like, guys will start to exile something, but they'll lay it sideways kind of on top of the graveyard. Like, don't let anything be vague. And if your opponent's doing it, point it out to them and have them clarify what it is and separate their stuff appropriately. I think one of my favorite habits that I picked up early is when I draw a card, I take it off the top of the deck, slide it on the mat towards me, and then lift it up. The whole point behind this is to make sure I'm not drawing two cards. You have a whole second there where it slides, the mat will kind of grip the bottom one and reveal a second, or it gives you just a few seconds there to make sure that it's just one card. This used to be a bigger deal when a card draw was an automatic game loss. Now the rules are a little bit different where you're not automatically losing the game, but they're still not favorable for you if you draw extra cards. They're going to look at your hand, take a card out. It gets shuffled back in, I think. Is that the ruling now?
Yep, that's it. It's a thought seized without the loss of two life, and the card doesn't go into the yard.
Yeah, so that can be very detrimental as they get to choose any card. So you may draw two lands off the top that you didn't need at all, and now you're losing the one good card you have. So it's worth it to take that extra second. Another great point for the drawing the card slowly like that is if they have something that they're trying to do during your upkeep, you know, that gives them a second to speak up to say, hey, I have an upkeep effect before you draw that card.
One thing I've done is I've actually been announcing the phases I'm in.
Yep.
From the very beginning. Untap, upkeep, draw. So they know immediately I'm moving through those three. I'm going quick. I'm doing nothing. I'm untapping my cards. I got no upkeep effects. I'm drawing my card. Because again, if they want to do something, they have that priority to do it.
Yep.
And then I take my draw, say I don't want to do anything main phase one. Then I say move to combat, and then I declare my attackers. So then again, at the end of main phase one, they can do something. So instead, I don't swing out, and they're like, oh, no, main phase one, I want to do this, because now they see you're swinging out.
Yeah, they know what attacks you're declaring. They know what you're going to do. You've leaked a little bit of information. Yeah, and I mean, you can get into, I don't know, what's the situation where if you draw a card and they didn't have a chance to respond in upkeep, do they just back you up to upkeep?
No, there is no backup at that point. It's a game warning to both players, one for failure to maintain game state, one for failure for communication.
Yeah.
They won't back it up.
Yeah, so you want to be sure that, I mean, upkeep, in Standard, there's not a lot going on in upkeep. When you get to Modern Legacy, there's a lot more, but there still are opportunities for upkeep things, especially with cards that trigger during upkeep, things like that, especially your own. So I don't say untap, upkeep, draw. I just say move to draw step as I reach towards my card. You know, but just as long as you have something in place to where they know we're skipping ahead. Because when you say to your opponent, move to draw step, if they say okay or acknowledge it, they've acknowledged that we are skipping upkeep.
Now, you're not actually skipping it. The point that you're trying to make is in higher level play, you need to be able to move at a faster pace because you're at 50-minute rounds to play three games of Magic. That can be a difficult and tall order to ask between if, say, two control decks are going at it against each other. You guys need to be able to utilize shortcuts. Shortcutting is appropriate and should be used to the maximum potential, but maintaining clear and precise communication with your opponent.
Yeah, skipping's a bad word to use because any upkeep effects still would happen. But the point is that you're saying we're moving on. You're passing priority. You have no additional effects during upkeep. Another great one to help tighten up your play is if you have your own upkeep effect, say an Obsidat, or what's a good one in Standard right now? From Beyond, you put a 1/1 in during your upkeep, right?
From Beyond, fantastic.
Yep. So a great way to remember this is put a die on top of your deck. That's perfectly legal to do at all tournament levels, and then that way when you go to draw your card, you see the die and you go, oh wait, that's right, I have something to do in upkeep before I draw that card. Because if you draw that card, you've now missed that upkeep trigger.
That was a big thing for me when I first started playing with upkeep effects is I'll get into my main phase one, I'll look down, and I miss something.
Yep, whoops. And sometimes it could be game loss. I mean, you've gotten something powerful that was going to happen that just you missed entirely. And that's what the ruling is going to be there is that you missed that trigger. It's gone. You can't back up to that. So really, I mean, any of these effects are things that you just want to be on top of what's going on at all points. It's very easy to feel time ticking down on you and you start to play a little faster. And that's why it's important to do these things consistently at the kitchen table, at home, at FN and Magic, at opens and on camera, wherever you are. You want to make sure you keep up these habits, because even though Magic's not a physical game, it's not football, it's not baseball, you still have muscle memory built into your brain that's going to make you do these things over and over and over. Do you guys have any other tips? Any other things you want to touch on here?
Can't remember if you covered this or not, but don't tap your lands and then take it back.
Yeah,
this
briefly, goes in, so that's a good one to touch
yeah,
on.
Yeah, with like taking in your line of play. Or don't separate your lands to be like, okay, I want to set aside one and two blue for scatter the winds, because your opponent's going to see that. And he's going to be like, oh, okay, he has a counter setup over there. He wants to make sure he has that mana setup. Now, you could be bluffing.
Yeah.
Which is perfectly fine.
And that's the caveat on that. Learn when bluffing is appropriate.
Yep. Yeah.
I constantly do the, all right, I'll set aside this counterspell magic over here or mana over here, but I've got lands in hand. But
things like that. And then whenever you go to cast a spell or anything like that, before you even think about casting it, if you need to read an opponent's card, we saw this earlier on the open, read their card first, see if you can do what you want to do, and then go from there.
Yeah, make sure the effect is going to do what you intended before you actually cast the spell. So, like, maybe you're not sure of a power level on a creature and you have a removal spell that only hits certain power levels. Any caveat like that where you want to make sure that it's going to go down the way you want it to, set your hand down, pick up their card, read it, make sure everything is right before you do anything else.
Before you pick up their card, ask if you can see their card.
There
please.
You go, that's a good one.
Don't just be like, oh, give me that.
Niceness thing.
That is...
No one likes grubby hands.
No.
the quick snatch. You always see it. Someone starts getting into the tank, and they do the quick snatch when you play the card. Like, it's not your card. It's still their cards. I mean, for someone, this may be a lot of money for them on the table. So, you know, being polite.
I've had to apologize a few times because I noticed I'll grab someone. I'm like, oh, sorry about that. I hope you don't mind. You know, usually they don't if you ask. No one ever really does, but it is good to just.
I like to think that's one of my better qualities. Hey, can I read that, sir? Yeah, thank you. And I'll read it.
Yep,
you know, I'm really good at that.
Yeah, so reading cards is another huge one. This leads us right into this. Be sure of what's going on. I read cards that I'm 100, like, I read cards that I could recite in my sleep, just because there may be something on there that clues me into something else. There may be something going on I haven't caught on. Like, it's always good to have perfect information. So why would you purposely exclude something that you could easily just read? Getting into that, that's another great one, is tracking information. Don't use dice to track your life total. Use pen and paper. Pen and paper trumps all. It's always been the best. It remains the best. And there's a real specific reason. If you have a judge dispute over, or a player dispute over life total, and you call a judge into it, the player who can show what has been happening is going to win. If someone has die out, the judge isn't going to side with them.
It's actually a game warning now not to write your life totals down. At the higher level, at the opens and stuff like that, it's a game warning.
They require either writing down or an electronic device that both players can see.
Yeah, and see, that's a good way to go, because one point of damage can mean everything. And I've had this happen to me twice now, where a player against me thought we had different life totals. They called the judge, and I was able to win the judge dispute because I could go through and say, look, here's where you lost one for your fetch land. Here's where you lost two for your shock land. Here's where you did this. And then they had one random damage to me that no one could identify.
And if you've got fast enough handwriting skills, you can note take each individual loss or gain of life. Why did it happen?
Yeah.
You can write it down.
An S for shock land. But
that's what I've started doing, especially with burn, where every point matters.
Yeah.
You know,
see, I don't go the full and jot down, but what I do is say my opponent fetches and gets an untapped shock land. I don't go 20-17. I go 20-19 and then 19-17.
Another good thing, too, is whenever you look at your opponent's hand, you have this paper now in front of you. You can write down his hand and keep track of it.
Yeah.
A big thing to note, too, is are the lands different? If they are, I make a note of it. I put the
foils
set
versus non-foils.
Yeah, foil versus non-foil. Oh, he's running two Blood Crypts. He has a Return to Ravnica, and the other one was what, Ravnica City of Guilds?
One of those three blocks.
Right.
So let's stay on writing down information, and we'll get to that in a second.
Okay, sorry.
Because I have very passionate feelings about that. But yeah, so, I mean, Thoughtseize is a good one. You see their hand. Write down what they have. Keep track of it. Scratch it out as it goes. Things like Courser of Crucifix is in play, where they're revealing the top card. Write it down each time they draw it. Like, just keep track of any card you know of that they have in their hand, and then scratch them off as they go. Don't try to remember that information. Like, I'm a very big proponent of everything I can get out of my brain, I get out of my brain. I write it down, I put it down, I do something with it to where I can just reference it when I need it. Magic is a taxing game, and if you're playing 10 rounds in a day or 9 rounds in a day, you're going to pay for all those little things that you're trying to remember rather than just writing them down. Just write them down. Get in the habit of it. Do it all the time. Sometimes you'll see when people are playing casually, and I know we all do it, we're guilty of it, we're being lazy. I'll Thoughtseize my friend, and I'll say, hey, can you just leave them revealed? And we do that. And that's a bad habit. We shouldn't be doing that. Don't do that. Write them down. Do it like that every time, because what's going to happen is you'll be playtesting, and then you'll go to a tournament, they'll reveal, you'll remember to write it down, but then as they're playing cards, you forget to scratch them off. So then all of a sudden, now that information's useless. You haven't kept up with it, you're not sure.
Another way to really help out with your note-taking skills is, you know, deck-dependent. Write down what, if you don't want to write down the whole thing, you're too slow of a writer or something, write down what is relevant to you. What affects you, your deck, the in any way, shape, or form to keep you from doing what you're going to do?
A good one with that, sorry to cut you off, is if a surprise card comes up in the deck, like say you know the deck, you're going up against red-green, and they just throw this random card out there, make a note of it. He's running this. So then it's still in the back of your mind come game two and game three.
Yeah, because when you go to sideboard, you may easily get into the, okay, this is how I sideboard for this match. But if you glance down and go, oh, wait, that's right, he had this main. Yeah, that's a great point, great point. But yeah, so even jotting down things like misplays you made, things that went wrong during the match. Maybe you haven't played this matchup very much and there's a card that really hosed you that you didn't think would do it quite that hard. So yeah, jot down the name of that card so that way you can kind of look at it once you get back, once you are readjusting your deck, things like that. But now, all right.
One final piece on the note-taking bit is any notes taken during a match have to be revealed to your opponent.
Oh yeah.
Note-taking cannot be taken off to the side. That constitutes for a warning. After several warnings, you'll receive game losses and possible DQs.
Yeah, so the point here is it's not like you have to sit here and go, okay, here's what I wrote down, but they need to be open and available if your opponent wants to read them, things like that.
It's got to be public.
It's got to be public information. You can't
so don't try
it.
To jot something down and flip the page. Now, and that's one where I don't even think there's many things you would want to write down in private. I mean, I guess if you said, I want to use this card or bring this card in, you wouldn't want to write that down.
You wouldn't want to write that down. Or, for example, you mentioned if you made a possible misplay, that could be something you don't want to write down because that information is visible to them, so now they know you have a certain something in your hand.
You had something else you could have done, and you just misplayed rather than you did your best. Or
I do abbreviations for that. I just put MP in the game that I'm playing. And if for whatever reason they ask, you know, what's an MP, generally they're not going to ask until the end of the game. And then it's like, oh, I had a misplay.
Yeah. And usually they're not going to ask, but it is a great point to make. Don't try to hide anything away. Don't pick up warnings for no reason.
Yeah, abbreviating is fine. If they don't understand abbreviation, as long as they don't ask, you don't have to reveal. But if they ask, got to talk.
So let's talk about card art. Because this is one that's huge to me. I rag on people constantly for this. If you're going to play more than one copy of a card in your deck, play the exact same card, like the same set, the same artwork, the same everything. And the reason for this is what Rob touched on a minute ago, where someone Thoughtseizes in, they see, okay, you have a foil Ravnica Island, you have a regular Zendikar full art island, they have another non-foil, you know, M15 island.
Yuck.
Yeah, now each time that you play an island, they can mark off specifically which island you played. Say you draw an island for your turn and you play it, and it's none of the mentioned three. Now they know that you still have those other three islands in hand. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they all looked the same, they have to assume that that's one of the islands they saw.
Yeah, because now they can start reading what your top decks are.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you exposed your hand, you played something that wasn't in his list.
Yep.
He knows that's your
Boom.
Top deck.
You top deck
and
an
if
island.
You keep
you got
doing
a bunch
that,
of them.
You're just giving him perfect information.
Yep. Yeah, so don't give away free information. A lot of players will argue about this and they'll say things like, oh, but you can just remember which islands they saw. But don't do that to your, like, what? Why would you even add an extra step? If you remember which islands. Well, now that's another thing you got to keep in your head, and maybe you have to jot it down and you have to scratch it off and just play the same art. You get around that entirely. The other thing is when you draw your card for the turn, a lot of people complain about the hand shuffling because of the noise it makes. They think it's annoying. I hand shuffle constantly, and the reason is because I don't want to reveal my top deck. If you draw a card from your deck and immediately play that land out, they know you drew a land for the turn. If you draw a creature and immediately play it, they know what you drew. Now, you know, half the time this may not be relevant. Maybe it doesn't matter what you drew. If they don't know your hand, then they don't know how many other lands you have, so on and so forth. But it's still, if you have the chance to give them a little information or no information, always go the path that gives them no information. Like, and this comes down to percentage points again. It may never cost you a game. It may win you one game in your Magic career, but that's one game more than you would have won otherwise.
And that could have been a deciding game to get you into a top eight.
Yeah, could have been a winning in. You know, so that's really the theme of this whole topic here is all these little things that you can do to just etch out a few percentage points here and there. Do you guys have any other examples? Anything that comes to mind for this? I think we covered everything on our list, but I know we're going to miss stuff. So as we come up with them, we'll definitely be sure to mention them in future casts.
And as you guys think of them, please give us the feedback on it.
Yeah, if we miss anything, shoot it in. If you have any good advice, any tips or tricks that you use for this type of thing, like, it's a significant part of Magic, and it's something that a lot of players don't even bother with. I mean, we were talking about watching the Open. We saw someone go to cast a spell and then double check something after casting it twice this morning. And these are good players. Like, these aren't bad players at all. And it's just, you just got to be in the habit. It's easy to make any of these mistakes. No one is a bad player for making these mistakes. No one's a noob or anything like that. It happens. They just haven't spent the time training themselves to not do it. So it's something that doesn't require a lot of effort. Once you become conscious of it, we talk about this all the time. Once you're aware of it, you can solve this problem a lot easier. But all right, so I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Any last final thoughts before we get out of here? All right, so as you know, next week we'll be announcing the winners for this giveaway. For anyone who hasn't heard, we're giving away 8 packs total of Battle for Zendikar. It's going to be 4 to one person and 2 to 2 other people. So for this week, we're going to add another way to get an additional entry. The original way, if you haven't yet, go leave some feedback on the page. Things you like, things you didn't like, you know the deal at this point. Leave us some feedback. That gets you an entry. If you've already done it, you got that entry. You're good to go. The other way to get an additional entry now is that if you go to our Facebook page and you share any of our episodes, that'll get you another additional entry. So we'll throw your name in twice to our big bingo wheel. Is that on the way? Is that shipping in?
Big bingo wheel was going to be a surprise, but it is indeed on the way. So
yes,
stand by for big bingo wheel next week.
At this point, I have no idea if he's being serious or not. We should get like the Plinko thing from Price is Right. Anyway, so that'll net you an additional entry. You'll be up to 2. Your odds are looking great at that point. So either of those helps us out a ton. We always appreciate anything people do for us to help spread the word, to help guide the cast and what we do as far as feedback goes. Like our Facebook page, we update every time we post new things. We're still looking for article submissions, so if you're interested in writing articles, just send us a comment, send us some feedback, whatever, however you want to contact us is fine. But that's going to do it for us this week. We'll see you all next week.
Oh, snap.